Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
I'm Angela Andrews.
And I'm Brent Semino. We're the hosts of a show we think you'll enjoy.
It's called Compiler.
Each episode, we talk to folks in tech who can help us learn about the world around us.
Together, we tackle questions big and small.
And sometimes strange.
Compiler.
An original podcast from Red Hat.
Looking for a new vacation destination? Why not Las Vegas? They have the top celebrities residencies on their calendar for this year with people like Adele, Beyonce, Katy Perry. They also have trend-setting pool parties, lavish nightclubs, A-list entertainment, top-tier shopping, outdoor adventure, and culinary experiences. Visitors to the destination can enjoy pool parties by lounging in luxurious cabanas. Don't get me started on a luxurious cabana. And bungalows while celebrity DJs spin the most popular beats. Or you can spend the day strolling through shopping meccas where fashionistas splurge at designer outlets. There's so much to do in Las Vegas, and they really do have something for everyone. So do yourself a favor, book a trip now, and make sure you get your tickets to your favorite show.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Nick Qureshi, and in the early hours of Monday, the 29th of May, these are our top stories. President Erdogan has won Turkey's runoff election. His defeated challenger Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu warns of dark days ahead. More top-level talks between President Biden and the most senior Republican in the House of Representatives to seal the deal on the US debt ceiling. And
in certain households, women were isolated in a particular room while they were menstruating or told to sleep on the floor and passed food through a door.
Some shocking stories about the treatment of girls and women when they're menstruating. Also in this podcast, President Yoweri Museveni launches an inquiry into the Ugandan army's retreat from a base in Somalia. And Malaysia's prime minister calls for an end to fawning coverage of his government and urges the press to be more critical. Turkey's electoral authorities have declared Recep Tayyip Erdogan the winner of the presidential election runoff, ensuring him another 5 years in office. They say Mr. Erdogan was the clear winner, coming 6 percentage points ahead of his challenger Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu, who complained the poll was unfair. Addressing jubilant supporters in Ankara, Mr. Erdogan promised to build a strong economy and called for unity. In 2 decades, as Prime Minister and President, Mr. Erdogan has moved Turkey in an increasingly Islamist direction, cracked down on dissent, and frequently scorned his NATO allies. Ola Guerin reports from Ankara.
The Recep Tayyip Erdogan juggernaut rolls on. And tonight in the Turkish capital, the streets belong to his supporters, who have stuck with him through thick and thin and hyperinflation.
We are blessed that our president is leading us again. There is no better feeling than this. Let the world hear it.
And here he was, serenading supporters, or trying to, from a bus stop near his home in Istanbul, having beaten off the biggest challenge in years. The only winner, he said, is Turkey, before stoking divisions with an attack on the opposition and the LGBTQ community. Earlier, he handed out cash outside a polling station like a modern-day sultan, one who has now extended his reign for another 5 years. His rival, Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu, ran as Mr. Nice Guy, but then veered right, vowing to send all refugees home. Supporters chanting his slogan today. everything will be beautiful. Now defeated, he says he fears much bigger troubles are ahead for Turkey. The choice here was stark. Two very different options, a seasoned autocrat or an untested democrat. Most voters went with the devil they know.
The process is carried out very carefully here. You have to arrive with a voting slip and with your ID. Your name is checked on the list, and after you vote, you sign that you have done so. There are observers here too from all the political parties. But President Erdogan has gone into this contest with key advantages, not least almost total control of the media.
Uzcan Akar, a retired lawyer of 90, came out to vote for change.
In Turkey currently, there's a dictatorial regime. I am voting to return to democracy. First of all, there is no justice. The president holds executive and legislative powers. This is the biggest mistake.
But tonight, packed victory celebrations outside the presidential palace of 1,000 rooms. Recep Tayyip Erdogan is newly emboldened. The opposition is badly bruised, and this strategic nation has chosen its path.
Well, again, after weeks of bitter negotiations, President Biden has reached a tentative deal with his Republican opponents to raise the national debt ceiling, which will allow the US government to borrow more money. However, the deal still needs to be approved by a divided Congress, and if politicians from both sides of the House fail to reach agreement, the US could default on its debt. Speaking to Fox News Sunday, the top Republican in the House of Representatives, Kevin McCarthy, said he was confident he'd be able to get the votes needed to approve the deal.
95% of all those in the conference were very excited. But think about this. We finally were able to cut spending. We were able to do this when the president said he wasn't even going to talk to us. We put a statutory cap on only spending 1% for the next 6 years. So we let government grow, but at a slower rate.
Kevin McCarthy. Well, further talks have been held to try to get politicians to back the deal. Our correspondent in Washington, Jessica Parker, gave me an update.
The conversations that actually matter at the moment are the ones that Republican leaders like Kevin McCarthy will be having with his own party and his own members of Congress, and likewise at the White House briefing Democrats, because as you were saying, what needs to happen next in order to get this deal approved is it needs to be voted through by the House of Representatives and the Senate. And I think while there is some confidence the numbers will be there, although not everyone's going to back this deal, there is nervousness as well, because there are potential pitfalls and political holdups, and this tight deadline they're facing of June the 5th, which is the point at the moment where the Treasury says they could run out of money in order to keep paying all their bills.
Yeah, just a few days away. What do we know about this deal?
They've been frantically drafting the legislation. A crucial element and a big win for the White House is it looks like it's going to raise the debt ceiling for 2 years. That matters because it means that President Biden won't be having this unruly fight just before he heads into a presidential election, because, of course, he intends to run for re-election for the Democrats. The Republicans are talking about how there are some curbs on federal spending. It's likely for the right of the Republican Party. Those curbs will not go far enough. Kevin McCarthy's also been championing this idea that he's won a concession from the White House. There'll be stricter work requirements for people who are in receipt of food assistance, what's known as food stamps, and they're clawing back some unspent COVID money as well. Joe Biden, though, put out a tweet last night. He was saying that kind of core programs that are really important to the Democrats have been protected, but the devil will be in the detail.
So can this deal still be vetoed?
If, for example, the numbers weren't there in the House of the Representatives or in the Senate, then it's not so much a veto as it just doesn't get through those chambers, and it's a piece of legislation. So it needs to. At the moment, there's a vote scheduled, we're told, for Wednesday, the House of Representatives, the Senate after that, then Joe Biden would have to sign it into law. So there are hurdles to get through, and they're working to a very tight deadline, and it's just an unpredictable situation. So, yes, there's a deal. I think that will be welcomed by financial markets, but they're not out of the woods yet.
Jessica Parker in Washington. President Volodymyr Zelensky has praised Ukraine's air defence forces after Russia's biggest drone assault on Kyiv since its invasion began. Most of the explosive unmanned aircraft were shot down, but two people were killed by falling debris. From Kyiv, here's our diplomatic correspondent, James Landale.
Kyiv has been celebrating its birthday. People took to the streets and parks, bars and restaurants to mark the anniversary of the city's foundation more than 1,500 years ago. It was a remarkable demonstration of resilience after a night that saw what officials said was the biggest drone attack on the capital since Russia's invasion last year. In all, they said more than 40 unmanned aircraft were shot down by the city's air defences. Inevitably, there was some damage caused by the resulting debris. Two people were killed, several others wounded. Some buildings were set on fire, including a large tobacco factory. President Zelensky praised Kyiv's defenders, thanking them for the many lives they had saved. Military commanders said that of the 59 drones launched against the whole country, 58 were brought down. Analysts say Russia is seeking to deplete and damage Ukraine's air defences ahead of its long-expected counter-offensive. This might have been the 14th air attack on Kyiv this month, but it won't be the last.
James Landale in Kyiv. The World Bank estimates at least 500 million women and girls globally, including in some rich countries, lack access to the facilities and products they need to manage their periods. Meanwhile, 1.25 billion women and girls have no access to a safe private toilet. These things, coupled with cultural stigma, are major contributors to what is called period poverty. Swara Patel is the founder of the Period Society, which works to promote menstrual equity and is a One Young World ambassador. She's been speaking to Krupa Paddy about her experience.
I grew up in Bombay till the age of 16, and I got my first period at the age of 12. And my school, even though it was a really good, well-reputed school, never educated us about menstruation. And this is also not a conversation that we had with our parents at home because of the hush-hush surrounding the topic. When I got my first period, I was just handed a pad by my mom and told how to use it. She told me to be discreet about the fact that I'm menstruating and not disdain myself. One of the first taboos that I was introduced to was being asked not to enter the temple from the next day onwards because my menstrual blood made me impure. I know people who were asked not to go to the kitchen or to touch the pickle jar while they were menstruating. And in certain households, women were isolated in a particular room while they were menstruating or told to sleep on the floor and passed food through a door.
I'm nodding here because I have family members who won't cook when they're on their menstrual cycle, like you just said. Is it too far, in your opinion, to call this a human rights issue?
Absolutely not. I think it is a human rights issue because the taboo surrounding menstruation snatches the equality of opportunity from about half of the world's population that will menstruate at some point. We're taught to be ashamed of our own bodies because of this very normal biological process. And also because we're taught to be discreet about menstruation, we never really think about period product as a basic need instead of a luxury. There's a luxury tax on period products in so many different countries, while groceries and medicines are often exempt. In India, it's estimated that about 23 million girls drop out of school every single year when they start menstruating because of a lack of access to period products.
So what needs to be done? I know your organization is a team of people working on changing this situation.
The Period Society, we're a group of young people all over India who serve as peer health educators. And one of the first things that really has to happen is make menstruation a part of the mandated sexual health curriculum at schools and start teaching kids about periods and get them to understand that it's a normal biological process. And we also need to include men and boys when we're having that conversation. We always try to negotiate negotiate with the authorities to have young boys in the session.
I really want to learn more about what you're doing in Jodhpur. You've got a pain simulator where men and boys can experience the extent of period pains. How does that work?
Under medical supervision, they have this period pain simulator, which is basically a device that works by sending small electrical impulses directly to your abdominal muscles, causing it to contract in a way that's similar to how you experience muscle contractions that lead to cramping during menstruation. And the whole point of doing this was that a lot of times, a lot of menstruators tend to experience period pain, but it's something that, again, isn't taken seriously and often invalidated in the workplace and in school.
Swara Patel speaking to Krupa Paddy. To Portugal next, and a housing crisis that's getting worse despite new government measures to try to control it. A combination of booming tourism, government measures to attract foreign investment, and the possibilities of remote working have sent house prices soaring, meaning that for many, doing two jobs has become an increasing necessity. And sometimes even that's not enough. Nowhere is it worse than in Lisbon, the country's capital, where the average rent is now three times the minimum wage. From there, António Fernandes reports.
Portuguese comedian and activist Diogo Faro posted this video on social media early this year about rocketing rent prices in Lisbon and accidentally became one of the faces of the country's affordable housing campaign.
Elderly people that are choosing between paying rent or medication, so they are shortening their lives to have a roof.
Faro got together with friends and started the movement Casa é Direito, a house is a right. They organized a demonstration that got more than 30,000 people out on the streets of Lisbon. Nurse Joelcy Pacheco didn't join the protests because she was working. Could she make her rent without working 16 hours a day?
With one job only, it wouldn't be difficult. It would be impossible. Most of my salary goes towards rent, not to mention bills or food. With one salary only, it would be nearly impossible.
And that's because the numbers just don't add up. The average rent price in Lisbon is now over 2,000 euros a month, but the minimum wage is still under 800 euros. Joelce is anxious about her rent going up.
It means it's likely I'll have to move back in with my mom, way further from work, and I'll have to restructure my entire life.
Joelce's case is far from unique. I'm a carer because that's what I love to do, says Georgina Simões. She earns slightly more than the minimum wage, but she still has to work two jobs to pay a rent of 300 euros, a low amount by Lisbon's current standards. But that's about to change.
The landlady has been chasing me since 2018. She says she needs the house. Now she's put an eviction notice. I didn't leave because when I look for a house, my salary won't be enough even to pay rent.
We still have a dysfunctional market and lack of balance between supply and demand. We're talking about rent prices in Lisbon that are higher than some of the richest areas of Berlin, for example.
That's Luís Mendes, a geographer and housing researcher who works at the University of Lisbon.
The first reason is touristification. As short-term rentals like Airbnb rose, it diverted houses from residential use to tourism.
And then there's government measures aimed at attracting foreign investment through tax-free schemes for investment funds, digital nomads, and, most of all, golden visas.
The golden visas allowed investors from outside the EU to get a resident visa in Portugal. But often they would redo a house but wouldn't give it any use. It would be empty. Many times those properties would then be sold time and time again. And that created a distortion on the housing market.
In a new housing program, the government is, amongst other things, putting a stop to golden visas and limiting how much rents can increase. But for many, it's too little, too late. And the anger continues.
António Fernandes with that report. Still to come on the Global News podcast.
There's so much darkness, there's so much destruction, but it's like one of the most epic places ever. Every night is like the last night. Let's go
all
the way.
You don't know what's coming tomorrow.
No, you don't. We learned that the hard way, I think.
Lebanon is in the grip of economic turmoil, yet Beirut's nightlife is still buzzing. when a reported 800 fighters from Somalia's Islamist group Al-Shabaab attacked a military base. The Ugandan peacekeepers manning it fled. Militants drove a car laden with explosives into the base belonging to the African Union, prompting a gunfight. Uganda's President Yoweri Museveni has now admitted that lives were lost in the panicked retreat and has demanded an inquiry. Since 2007, Al-Shabaab has tried to topple Somalia's Western-backed government and replace it with a strict interpretation of Islamic law. Our Africa regional editor Richard Hamilton started by telling me more about the attack.
Al-Shabaab have said that they killed 137 Ugandan soldiers, but in the past Al-Shabaab has tended to grossly exaggerate these sorts of casualty figures. The United States then later retaliated and conducted airstrikes, destroying what they said were weapons and equipment that had been stolen from the base. It's difficult to be precise about these casualties. Uganda has not given any figures themselves.
This must be humiliating for Uganda.
Yes, and President Museveni has almost made it worse by criticising his own soldiers for panicking and fleeing. Now, he's not said how many people died, and the problem with that can be seen in something similar that happened in 2016 when more than 100 Kenyan soldiers were killed in an African Union base. And the Kenyan government basically covered it up, and that made it worse. And so there was speculation. And one pundit said, silence is not a winning strategy in the world of strategic communications. So perhaps it's unwise that the Ugandans are not saying how many people died.
Is this a sign of Al-Shabaab's strength, what has happened here?
It's very difficult to assess just how strong Al-Shabaab is, but every time the government in Mogadishu says we're going to defeat them, they seem to almost deliberately come back. So the new president, Hassan Sheikh Mohamud, last year when he came to power, his sort of main manifesto was to defeat Al-Shabaab, and he said that he would declare total war on Al-Shabaab and would accept nothing less than their total surrender. The problem is that hasn't happened. He made a similar pledge when he was previously in power in 2012. He said he would defeat them within 2 years. That didn't happen. So again, there have been reprisals. There was a massive suicide bombing last October in Mogadishu. It was the worst in 5 years. About 120 people died. And again, this attack shows how difficult they are to defeat. And the African Union force has said that it will scale down its presence and eventually withdraw by the end of 2024, and that it will hand over to Somali government troops. The problem with that is you might have another Afghanistan, you might have the international community pulling out, and just as the Taliban took over, worst case scenario for the government in Mogadishu is that Al-Shabaab takes over the country.
Richard Hamilton. Let's turn to Nepal, which is a mecca for trekkers. But it's estimated up to 15 people go missing each year while hiking alone. So from April, the authorities have introduced a controversial new rule. Madeleine Drury visited one of the country's most popular trekking regions to find out more.
That bellowing laugh belongs to longtime guide Pasang Sherpa.
I feel so happy, you know, because it's not about the money, it's just about the most safety. At least we wish, we warn the people safely back to their home.
In the 15 years he has shared Nepal's landscape with trekkers, Pasang has assisted multiple helicopter rescues for people suffering with altitude sickness alone. He believes without a guide, the outcome may not have been as good.
Within a one and a half months, it changed a lot.
Just over 12 kilometres away in Chom Luang, Nitra Sunna is stamping permits. He is in charge of checking that hikers have the right paperwork. It's the last official stop before making the popular climb up to Annapurna Base Camp.
I can see that the number of solo trekkers has gone down, but solo travellers keep coming. I have not been given any authority to implement this rule. I tell them, we have nothing in writing, nothing in black and white. If we are authorised, then we are ready for it.
The tourism board says any checkpoints who have not received the authorisation will receive it very soon, as they're reviewing the checkpoints for effective implementation. As for Nepal's crown jewels, the Everest region, a row has been brewing.
In our region, in Everest region, my message for solo trekkers is welcome.
hold them in our region.
That's Minga Chiri Sherpa.
I'm the mayor of this Khumbu Pashalama rural municipality.
For the 40,000 trekkers who have already crossed into his region this year, Minga says they have not been enforcing the rule on those going solo.
They never did any kind of consultation with us. They never asked with the stakeholders. They are digging this, they are making this kind of rule for the benefit of the agency.
Nepal's tourism board says all regions have known about the rule change for some time and say they are working together to resolve the issue.
There it is, Annapurna Base Camp.
Back in the Annapurna region, Pasang guides the group to base camp in one piece.
Madeline Drury reporting from 4 kilometres above sea level. The US and Mexican authorities are urging the World Health Organization to declare a public health emergency over a fungal outbreak linked to cosmetic surgery in Mexico. It's a popular destination for Americans looking for cheaper procedures like liposuction and buttock lifts. But the US Center for Disease Control says two people returning from cosmetic surgery in Mexico have contracted fungal meningitis. Dr. Lenora Saxinger is an infectious diseases doctor at the University of Alberta in Canada. James Menendez asked her what fungal meningitis is.
Any meningitis is inflammation of the spinal fluid and spinal linings, and it can also, of course, surround the brain. And it's often actually a case where you'll get both meningitis, which causes a stiff, painful neck, and also some involvement of the central nervous system. So people can also have reduced level of consciousness, terrible headache. It can be very difficult to treat.
Is it life-threatening?
Absolutely. I mean, even when we know exactly what the fungus is, there's often a lot of challenges treating it properly because we have a smaller menu of antifungal drugs to choose from versus antibiotics. And not all antibiotics actually get into the spinal fluid very well or into the brain very well. And in the situations that are being reported now, there's quite a high mortality rate in the past. So that's a big concern.
How do you think the fungus got into the systems of these people who went for this cosmetic surgery? How might they have picked it up?
I don't want to anticipate the investigation too much, but commonly you look at the medications that are being injected into the epidural space or into the spinous fluid itself, because they use that for local anesthesia. The fact that there's actually two different aesthetic hospitals involved in the outbreak kind of suggests that it might be, you know, not just a local storage or local needle situation. It might have to do with actually where it's being manufactured. And they'd be looking at all the medications that would go into those anesthetic procedures.
Just wondering what the link might be with cosmetic surgery tourism. Is it because the clinics are trying to save money, perhaps, or that their procedures aren't completely watertight? What might it be?
The, you know, standards of infection control, manufacturing, etc., can vary a lot from place to place. And some place can have a lovely website and a very clean looking facility and still not necessarily have the kind of background inspection and assessment of aseptic procedures that you'll see in other countries. It also could just be bad luck. So it's not necessarily where it is so much as what the processes are for cross-checking the safety of products. And I guess the final thing that's a bit of a worry, honestly, to me, following medical tourist-related infections is occasional and less dramatic infections might actually fall under the radar because the clinics see people, they do the procedure, the person goes back home. And if there's an outbreak, it's occurring in many different places at once. And so no one is aware that this could be part of an outbreak, not just a unfortunate single circumstance.
Would you go to Mexico for liposuction, tummy tuck?
I don't think I would go anywhere for that, but I don't want to label any particular place. But if you're traveling somewhere for a cheap procedure, sometimes you honestly might get what you pay for. And even very reputable places, again, the structures that are in place to safeguard patients vary from place to place. So there's buyer beware associated with this.
Dr. Lenora Saxinger speaking to James Menendez. Malaysia's Prime Minister Anwar Ibrahim has told media to stop self-censoring and criticise him without fear. He was speaking at an event marking National Journalists Day. The details from Will Leonardo.
Comments by a country's leader inviting more media criticism tend to be rare, but Anwar Ibrahim said press freedom was a key part of his government's agenda. The Malaysian Prime Minister told journalists to air opposition views and stop the old practice of writing favourably about those in power. The country is in a region where reporters are being ever more constrained, but Malaysia has bucked this trend, jumping 40 places in the latest World Press Freedom Index. The compilers noted Mr. Anwar's diverse coalition government taking power as a factor. But some rights groups remain critical, saying he's been slow to repeal legislation used in the past to silence critics, including from his own party. Mr. Anwar himself had spent years in jail on sodomy and corruption charges many considered to be politically motivated.
Will Leonardo there. With its currency in shreds, much of its population living below the poverty line, and a great chunk of its waterfront still recovering from an enormous explosion in its port nearly 3 years ago, well, you'd think the Lebanese capital of Beirut would struggle to maintain a club scene. Well, you'd be wrong. If there's one thing Beirutis know how to do, well, it's to party. In the face of extraordinary adversity, its clubs, once some of the hottest in the Middle East, are still buzzing. Frank McQueenie stepped into Beirut's nightlife.
Entering the cargo elevator to reach the club, when you're going up, you hear the music going closer and closer and closer. You get pumped up as you go up, and then the two doors of the elevator open up and you see something that you wouldn't expect here in the heart of this industrial area.
This is Jade, a DJ, producer and founder of The Grand Factory, one of Beirut's most loved underground music spaces since 2014. It reopened its doors last January, almost 3 years on from one of the world's biggest non-nuclear explosions.
It's still a work in progress. It was a problem sourcing material due to the crisis.
Can you give me a bit of an idea of what it's like to actually try and run something like this in an environment like Beirut?
So first of all, no electricity. We have to buy generators and buy our fuel. A country that has no infrastructure. Trash crisis, water crisis, no government for a while, then one of the biggest non-nuclear explosion ever. Problems with the elections. To survive such a rough environment and such a tough city where you don't have an influx of tourists, where you don't have a stable economy, where you don't have any assistance, you have to be 10 times more organized.
It's 1 a.m. at the Grand Factory. The party is just getting started. The ceiling is about 5 meters high and huge windows. Directly on my right is the Beirut seaport. And in front of me, the stage. We're facing northeast. I can see the city lights going up a small part of Mount Lebanon mountain range.
In spite of Lebanon's worst crisis in generations, Jade found ways to keep the club going.
Giving free entrances for an hour. Anybody that buys a ticket for our monthly or bi-monthly warehouse events, they get free entrance to all our club nights. It's been a struggle. Let's see. I'm positive, but we have to keep the energy high.
It's 2 a.m. and I'm seeing a lot of smiles and hands in the air moments. Tough challenges have been overcome and I can sense a strong determination to keep dancing despite those that lie ahead.
Today we party as a form of survival. Before people used to say the Lebanese, they party to forget. No, really, like, it's a statement.
Wasp Boumalham is a DJ and producer who's playing shortly.
I'm playing a bit of my production, Haram Electric. Haram Electric for me is the sound that I wanted to hear growing up. My generation was more geared towards the West because there wasn't alternative Arabic music happening in the region.
Hi, my name is Blue Pfeiffer. I'm an artist, producer, director and pole dancer, and I'm the founder of Lebanese label Mafi Budget, which translates to There Is No Budget. There's so much work to be done. There's so much darkness. There's so much destruction. But it's like one of the most epic places ever. Every night is like the last night. Let's go
all
the way.
You don't know what's coming tomorrow.
No, you don't. We learned that the hard way, I think.
When you analyze that feeling that you see at night, it is the biggest example that music brings people together.
A report from Frank McQueenie. That's all from us for now, but there'll be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on Twitter at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Caroline Driscoll. The producer was Emma Joseph. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Nick Qureshi. Until next time, goodbye.
Thank you. Oh my goodness, I'm so happy you came through.
That's the sound of Kim getting a random act of helpfulness. We just told her the helpful SoCal Honda dealers will be paying for her dog's much-needed MRI, and we paid her for sharing that story on the radio. And we can help you, too, with a great deal on a reliable, award-winning Honda, like the 2023 CR-V. To find the helpful SoCal Honda dealer near you and to submit a random act of helpfulness for someone you know, visit SoCalHondaDealers.com.
Looking for a new vacation destination? Why not Las Vegas? They have the top celebrities' residencies on their calendar for this year, with people like Adele, Beyonce, Katy Perry. They also have trend-setting pool parties, lavish nightclubs, A-list entertainment, top-tier shopping, outdoor adventure, and culinary experiences. Visitors to the destination can enjoy pool parties by lounging in luxurious cabanas, don't get me started on a luxurious cabana, and bungalows while celebrity DJs spin the most popular beats, or you can spend the day strolling through shopping meccas where fashionistas splurge at designer outlets. There's so much to do in Las Vegas, and they really do have something for everyone. So do yourself a favor, book a trip now, and make sure you get your tickets to your favorite show.